In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
So we're going to talk about chapters 4 through 6 in Grandin's Empire's Workshop. Grandin writes that the new imperialism that became entrenched in the Reagan years reflected a U.S. desire to overcome the factionalism and disenchantment that had plagued the U.S. since the 1960s. You remember the bad 1960s. However, when looked at from the perspective of widening democracy and civic involvement, I would argue that these anti-establishment movements were actually healthy challenges to our ruling class and political system, and I'll get back to that. It was the Vietnam War, Grandin asserts, that led to a deep skepticism that shattered the governing consensus that it held sway for the first two decades after World War II. In what seemed a remarkably short period of time, the institutional pillars of society, universities, churches, newspapers, movies, Congress, the judiciary, that had previously buttressed government legitimacy, began to lean against it, advancing what some conservative critics came to deride as a permanent adversary culture. I would suggest that Grandin inflates institutional dissent and the so-called adversary culture. It was dissenters within those institutions who went against the dominant consensus, not the institutions themselves. Influential officials in the United States did not oppose imperialism, and not one board of trustees of any major university in the United States condemned U.S. policies, even after the May 1970 killings of students at Kent State University in Ohio, which we all know about, and most people know nothing about the killings of the two students at Jackson State, which was on May 15, 1970. They didn't count. Despite tactical criticisms about U.S. policy during the Vietnam War, no major U.S. media outlet opposed the war in principle. Their so-called opposition came after the Tet Offensive in early 1968 made it clear that the U.S. could not win. The judiciary, for its part, refused to confront the war, even though it violated the U.S. Constitution, the U.N. Charter, and the Nuremberg Charter. Grandin's analysis, therefore, exaggerates the nature and depth of anti-war and anti-imperialist sentiment in the United States during that era and into the 1980s. He states that the lingering Vietnam syndrome, this disease that we got in the country, among the U.S. public was countered under Reagan with an extensive propaganda campaign against dissidents at home that opposed imperialist attacks on Central America. This included an attack on the adversarial press that has not really been that adversarial about imperialism in Central and South America. He goes on to say that the propaganda effort also had to tame a presumptuous Congress and make inroads on college campuses. And this was done with a sophisticated and centralized public diplomacy campaign that deployed tactics drawn from both the PR world and the intelligence community. The White House also either loosened or circumvented restrictions placed on domestic law and order tactics that the FBI and other intelligence agencies had used to intimidate the anti-war movement of the 1960s. Finally, and most consequentially, it built grassroots support to counter what seemed a permanently entrenched anti-imperialist opposition. I would suggest it was much more anti-war than anti-imperialist. This propaganda assault coordinated the work of the National Security Council with PR firms, psychological warfare specialists, and new right activists, intellectuals, and pressure groups. The office also worked closely with conservatives who raised millions through front organizations. The terrorist attacks in Central America were critical in establishing the basis for what Grandin calls the third conquest of Latin America that continues today under the Bush regime. Although he recognizes that the promotion of capitalism has long been a concern of American foreign policy, the kind of capitalism advanced by the Bush Doctrine is innovative, at least in its arrogant disregard for history. It is a militarized and moralized version that, under the banner of free trade, free markets, and free enterprise, often makes its money through naked dispossession. As Noam Chomsky and others have argued, however, the banner of free markets is really government and mass media spin for public consumption. Not one of the proponents of free markets would ever put it into practice. The third conquest follows Spanish conquistadores, U.S. corporations, and multinational banks, the U.S. Treasury Department, and the International Monetary Fund. It is continued under George W. Bush and promoted not reform capitalism, but raw capitalism. Grandin links this economic imperialism in Latin America to the free market absolutism now being imposed on Iraq and indispensable to understanding the power of the new imperialism. In important ways, the road to Iraq passes through Latin America, starting first in Chile. These free market policies in Chile and elsewhere, of course, could not have succeeded without national security, state violence against progressive forces. In Grandin's view, the fundamental shift in Latin America began in 1973, when the U.S. was hit with the twin blows of the sharply rising oil prices and a 17-month recession. This led to a sharpened sense of class consciousness and a unity of action among corporate leaders who now rapidly increased their funding of right-wing organizations dedicated to the dismantling of economic regulations and social entitlements. Tragically for progressive force, I would argue, this dominant elite class consciousness was not matched by a similar rise among the middle and lower classes in the United States, as ruling class hegemony prevailed against a public that was largely uninformed, confused, and unorganized. In Latin America, the U.S. ruling class set out to crush Third World economic nationalism, which was increasingly identified as an obstacle to economic recovery. In 1974, retired General Maxwell Taylor expressed this view when he stated that the U.S. was threatened by a turbulent and disorderly Third World. We were the leading affluent have power and thus should expect to have to fight for our national valuables against envious have-nots. Taylor's blunt class consciousness contrasted dramatically with the lack of such class consciousness and activism on the part of the public. Grandin states that the synthesis of the goals of corporate America with the passion and ideas of a nationalist backlash created a perfect storm of resurgent U.S. expansionism that would force on the rest of the world the kind of economic regime first institutionalized in Chile. This effort was carefully orchestrated and nurtured by powerful multinational corporate and political groups. He is on the mark when he claims that Reagan's policies halted and then began the reversal of what some economists had identified as a dangerous trend, namely the democratization of wealth brought about by union power, a progressive corporate and personal income tax code, education spending, low unemployment, and social welfare programs. Imagine, these were really dangerous for the country. They were dangerous to the degree that they challenged U.S. ruling class power. Therefore, a systematic effort was undertaken in the 1970s to curb what was called democratic distemper. You know, you could get a tetanus shot in the 70s against democratic distemper. Of the movements that arose in the U.S. in the 60s to challenge domestic and imperial U.S. power. The challenge to U.S. policies and the counterattack discussed in Grandin really began to emerge under President Carter. As discussed by V.G. Kiernan in his America, the New Imperialism, it was Samuel Blowtorch Huntington, Democrat, Harvard professor, and former Pentagon advisor during the Vietnam War, who was the author of the forced urbanization theory in Vietnam, which was to literally bomb the shit out of every piece of rural area in Vietnam and drive people into the cities in order to deny the National Liberation Front their guerrilla base. He diagnosed this democratic distemper and a crisis of democracy caused by previously passive or unorganized groups in the population who have now embarked on concerted effort to reestablish their claims to opportunities and privileges which they had not considered themselves entitled to before. Black people, women, working people, gay people, students. Upset at the public's willingness to challenge the legitimacy of hierarchy, coercion, discipline, secrecy, and deception, which are in some measure, he argued, inescapable attributes of the process of government, Huntington concluded on an elitist note. The effective operation of a democratic political system usually requires some measure of apathy and non-involvement on the part of some individuals and groups. And we know which groups ought to stay apathetic and non-involved. Huntington's views were part of the Crisis of Democracy report for the Trilateral Commission, a body founded by David Rockefeller in 1972 that would later supply some of the heart of the leadership of the Carter administration. In fact, I would argue it was the trilateralists that gave us Jimmy Carter as president. No one knew anything about the peanut farmer governor from Georgia. The aim was to use the power and propaganda of the U.S. government and the corporate media to neutralize and marginalize those infected with this democratic distemper so they would not disrupt the genocidal U.S. attack on Central and South America. Grandin asserts that progressive reforms in Latin America had to be attacked because they brought increased equality and produced new social groups demanding increased political and social democracy. Imagine that. Demands to which the region's ruling classes, under the cover of the Cold War and with tech support provided by the Pentagon, responded with wholesale slaughter. A similar effort was undertaken to crush dissidents here in the United States, though in a much less violent way. The new imperial policies devastated the poor throughout South America, but in Central America, the situation was much worse. According to Grandin, the economic devastation that began a quarter century ago has actually accelerated. 60% of the inhabitants of Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador live below the poverty level, a situation that has grown worse since the wars of the 1980s ended. Panama fares no better, plagued as it is by corruption, violence, high unemployment, and severe malnutrition. This human catastrophe, however, is an acceptable price to pay for the U.S. ruling class and its apologists, far more acceptable than those periods when the poor organized militant and armed struggles in resistance. As long as the oppressed do not threaten their own ruling elites and U.S. protectors, we will hear little to nothing about the desperate conditions in the region. But Grandin tells us that the U.S. ruling circles are worried again because there's a rising social democratic movement in Latin America, most personified by Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. This hopeful movement is countered, however, by many among the poor who continue to seek remedy through more vengeful outlets, such as right-wing nationalism, religious fundamentalism, or street gang brutality. Most likely, they join the ranks of the forgotten victims or perpetuators of staggering levels of violence throughout the Americas. Grandin reminds us that when President Hugo Chavez began to criticize the IMF model, the White House openly backed the plotters who attempted to depose him in spring 2002. And after 9/11, the Bush administration added critics of neoliberalism to its growing list of hemispheric security concerns. Radical populism was increasingly considered to be an emerging threat, and Chavez and Evo Morales of Bolivia were singled out as potential terrorists who took advantage of deep-seated frustrations of the failure of democratic reforms to deliver expected goods and services. Despite these horrific conditions, the U.S. does very little to alleviate the poverty that even the Pentagon admits fuels the war and drug trade. Why do that? Given the premises of imperialism, however, the U.S. government can't alleviate these problems because it created them. It's the criminal. Without fundamental social and economic change here at home, therefore, we cannot expect any genuine U.S. effort to help end desperation in Latin America. So we face an intractable dilemma with no good solution. The U.S., according to Grandin, promotes an economic model that produces not development and stability, but desolation and crisis. This should not shock us. That's its purpose. As such, the U.S. is once again relying on hard power to protect its interests against the resurgence of a new continent-wide democratic left. U.S. interests, of course, are the interests of the dominant elite here that covers itself with the mantle that it represents the national interest, not the broad democratic interest of the populace at large. Grandin's final point, is absolutely critical if we are to grasp the truth about U.S. imperialism. And I quote, "The most important lesson taught by the history of the United States in Latin America is that democracy, social and economic justice, and political liberalization have never been achieved through an embrace of empire, but rather through resistance to its command." This assertion seconds the insight of Samir Amin, whom I quoted in our last class, "The intervention of the North in the affairs of the South is in all its aspects negative. Never have the armies of the North brought peace, prosperity, or democracy to the peoples of Latin America. In the future, as in the past, they can only bring further servitude, the exploitation of their labor, the expropriation of their riches, and the denial of their rights. Therefore, the only democratic option is the one Grandin and Amin lay out, resistance to the commands of the imperialists." A number of scholars have seconded the theses put forward in Grandin's book. Tariq Ali's Pirates of the Caribbean argues that U.S. imperialism in Latin America has created a situation where the real crime is to challenge the certainties of the new order, to disregard the forbidden signs of the Western consensus. To Ali, the choices are clear. Either one pushes for U.S. imperial policies, or one attempts to create an altogether different program which prioritizes not market values, but human needs. The latter is underway in various areas of South America that is on the march again, offering hope to a world that is suffering daily from the military and economic depredations of the new order. This is the resistance to the commands of the rich and powerful forces that created and sustained imperialism, the end of Grandin's analysis in Chapter 6. In The Culture of Terrorism, Noam Chomsky discusses U.S.-supported genocidal and imperial violence against Central America. He argues that this assault must be placed within the larger context of overall U.S. foreign policy. The central, and not very surprising, conclusion that emerges from the documentary and historical record is that U.S. international and security policy, rooted in the structure of power in the domestic society, has as its primary goal the preservation of what Chomsky says we might call the fifth freedom, understood crudely but with a fair degree of accuracy as the freedom to rob, exploit, and dominate, to undertake any course of action to ensure that existing privilege is protected and advanced. This guiding principle was overlooked when Franklin Delano Roosevelt announced the four freedoms that the United States and its allies would uphold in the conflict with fascism in World War II. That was the freedom of speech and of worship, the freedom from want and from fear. Chomsky harshly criticizes the mass media and leading intellectuals that have largely accepted and internalized the basic framework of the government doctrine throughout. This is the doctrine that Grandin explains in great detail in Empire's Workshop. In Chomsky's view, Reagan's activist foreign policy assaults against Central America were at an extreme of the political spectrum, but within the framework of general U.S. principles that he argues have included intervention, subversion, aggression, international terrorism, and general lawlessness. Quite a combination. The staggering levels of violence during these years, he's referring to the late 70s and 80s, were generally supported by an elite opinion across the political spectrum, apart from tactical disagreements. And he goes on to say that they were policies initiated by the liberal Carter administration, including the military buildup, which largely follows its projections, the dismantling of the welfare state, the terrorist slaughter in El Salvador, and so on. There are differences, but they are within a general tendency, in Chomsky's view, that has won wide agreement. The Democratic opposition broadly supported these policies in the 70s and 80s, even the attack against Nicaragua, all part of the bipartisan empire thesis that's presented by Robert Jensen that we'll examine shortly. The self-image of American elites, Chomsky writes, reveals the U.S. as a lawless and violent state and must remain so independently of such nonsense as international law, the World Court, the UN, or other international institutions. U.S. international terrorism is scandalous only if it infringes upon the prerogatives of the powerful or carries a potential cost to elite interests. Therefore, the successful use of terrorism is not considered a scandal in the United States. On the contrary, it is welcomed and applauded. Key to understanding U.S. imperialism in Latin America, therefore, in Chomsky's view, is getting to the historical and institutional roots of exploitation and violence. This means rejecting the thesis that problems are basically the result of the failings of incompetent individuals, not traced to their institutional roots. And crucially, the nobility of U.S. intentions must be protected from any challenge. Thus, although Reagan's policies were foolish, incompetent, out of control, the U.S. always moved abroad with fine intention. It may make mistakes, but it never commits crimes. Chomsky didn't just condemn the obvious butchery of the Reagan administration in Central America, but he challenged liberals when he takes on Mr. Human Rights, Jimmy Carter. As he states, Carter's Human Rights Administration, for example, strongly supported both Somoza and the Shah. Congressional legislation reflecting popular dissidents from the late 1960s placed some constraints on direct aid to Somoza. So the Carter administration was compelled to rely on Israel to provide arms and advisors, while Somoza's National Guard killed some 40 to 50,000 people in its final paroxysm of violence. The fundamental premise for U.S. elite control of such brutal right-wing gangsters throughout the world, in Chomsky's view, stems from the broad agreement that the U.S. cannot tolerate any threat to the rule of the brutal and regressive elements that prevent or stand in the way of the establishment of nationalist regimes that will be responsive to the needs and concerns of their own populations. This guiding principle has been laid down in secret planning documents. The traditional U.S. hostility to democracy and human rights remains without challenge. We discussed Felix Green's analysis of U.S. imperialism in a previous class, and it is quite applicable to our discussion of Grandin in Latin America. Green's basic thesis is similar to that made by the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, is that we are dealing with poor countries that are enormously rich. Thus, it becomes clear it is because of their wealth that they are colonized. Green shares data on Latin America that support this assertion. It has more cultivable, high-yield tropical soil than any other continent, at least 3 times as much agricultural land per capita as Asia, the biggest reserves of timber in the world. Buried in it are vast reserves of minerals embracing virtually every metal and every industrial chemical known to man. And with its oil and hydroelectric power, it constitutes one of the greatest untapped reservoirs of energy. He asks a fundamental question that can only be addressed if one has an anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist perspective. How is it that nations with such rich resources, supplying such vast quantities of the world's essential materials, remain so appallingly impoverished? In his scholarly work on U.S. imperialism, the economic historian and sociologist André Gunder Frank critiques the dependency process that keeps the imperial center, the U.S., intact and powerful, and the exploited areas such as Latin America poor. He states, the metropolis, the center, expropriates economic surplus from the satellites and appropriates it for its own economic development. The satellites in Latin America and Central America remain underdeveloped for lack of access to their own surplus. One and the same historical process of expansion and development throughout the world generated and continues to generate both economic development and structural underdevelopment. These processes are but sides of the same coin. You cannot have one without the other, as misery feeds wealth and vice versa. We simply need to move back from Grandin's discussion of imperialism and its natural byproduct, poverty, to a Newsweek story 30 years ago that was cited in Green to see how nothing has changed. And I quote, "Just a few hours by jet from New York live more than 200 million people in the vast regions of Latin America, and it is doubtful whether one-tenth of them know what it is like to go to bed with a full stomach. The great cities glitter opulently, but beyond the glitter and in the hinterland are odious and despondent slums where Indian children scrounge for scraps and handouts while their parents labor for wages of 20 cents a day or less." The Newsweek article concludes, "This is the wasteland of the Western Hemisphere, a land of misery whose poverty is as stark as any in the world." Newsweek was and remains an eminently mainstream media source. Since then, however, tens of millions of peasants have been forced off the land in Latin America to become the truly destitute and marginal in its growing megacities. And Mike Davis's latest book, Planet of Slums, discusses that in incredibly graphic ways. And these are home to a staggering level of poverty that has helped to feed the wealth of the U.S. elite and its Latin counterpart. It's not just everyone's poor. There's incredible wealth in all of these cities in Latin America and in the United States. Another scholar who supports Grandin's analysis is Robert Jensen of the University of Texas. In an article on the bipartisan empire for ZNet, Jensen rightly claims that illegal and immoral U.S. aggression is and has always been a bipartisan affair. Democrats and liberals are responsible for their share of death, destruction, and misery caused by U.S. empire building, along with Republicans and conservatives. Although he admits that the current Bush regime and the neocons are a problem, he argues they are not the problem. Sweep this particular gang of thugs and thieves out of office, and what? A kinder and gentler imperial policy designed by Democrats is still an imperial policy, and imperial policies always have the same result: the suffering of millions, others that are too often invisible to us in support of policies that protect our affluence. His arguments about the imperialist policies of the so-called opposition party, the Democrats, make liberals uncomfortable. But these arguments must be confronted, for his essential charge, I would argue, is absolutely true. The political elites of the United States are united in their acceptance of empire. Whatever their particular policy proposals, they all lie about the nature of the system that has produced U.S. power and affluence. They all invoke mythical notions of the fundamental decency of the United States, and because of that, they are all part of the problem, which is inherent to empire. As he states, no imperial nation state has ever had any fundamental decency, even though, of course, there are decent people within it. The rich first world nations of this world got rich through violence and theft. Jensen also, as Chomsky, has the audacity to challenge Jimmy Carter's human rights policies in Central America. He says, a concern for human rights was not in evidence in Carter's policy toward El Salvador, as witnessed by Carter's response to a letter that Archbishop Romero wrote to Carter, pleading with him to support human rights by ending U.S. funding and arms transfers to the death squad government that was supported by the U.S. Romero wrote that, quote, your government's contribution will undoubtedly sharpen the injustice and the repression inflicted on the organized people. Carter ignored Romero's appeal, however, and continued to support the brutal military dictatorship that put guns in the hands of death squads, including one that would assassinate Romero 1 month later. Lest we think that Carter's support of genocidal levels of violence in El Salvador is some aberration in U.S. policy, the activist and writer Arundhati Roy provides a brief synopsis of our imperialist aggression throughout the world. Just since World War II, the United States has been at war or attacked, among other countries, it's not a complete list, Korea, Guatemala, Cuba, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Grenada, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Yugoslavia, and Afghanistan. This list should also include the U.S. government's covert operations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the coups it has engineered, and the dictators it has armed and supported. I would argue that since World War II, no country's record of violence and aggression comes even close to that of the United States. Therefore, one must marvel at the ability of the propaganda machine here, government and mass media, that can bury this truth and convince U.S. citizens that we only go abroad to defend ourselves from attack and extend freedom and democracy. The brilliance of this propaganda effort is Orwellian in its reach and accomplishment. Kiernan's work on America, the New Imperialism, also complements Grandin's insights about the U.S. role in Latin America. He is especially critical of what he terms the Reagan-Bush era of militarized neoliberalism and cites the comment of Michael Ledeen, who's with the American Enterprise Institute, who's one of the neoconservative movement's most admired figures. He cites Ledeen to reveal the underlying truth of U.S. policy. Speaking in the early 1990s, Ledeen stated, and it's just an amazing quote, and it's not made up. This is Michael Ledeen. Every 10 years or so, the United States needs to pick up some crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show that we mean business. What a guy. This is the unvarnished core truth and foundation of imperial attacks in Latin America and elsewhere, minus the usual spin about democracy and human rights. Ledeen's refreshing honesty fascistic, but it's refreshing, should jar us from our naive belief that we live in a nation that has the faintest concern for decency. Shattering such a belief is the first step in educating ourselves to the horrible reality of U.S. policies in the global South. In my book on education and imperialism, which was entitled Civic Illiteracy and Education, The Battle for the Hearts and Minds of American Youth, I cite the work of historian and activist Michael Parenti, who we'll be reading in the next couple of months, who argues that to understand political power in the U.S., and therefore to understand imperialism in Latin America, we must confront the fact that almost all social institutions existing in the society are under plutocratic control, ruled by non-elected, self-selected, self-perpetuating groups of affluent corporate representatives who are answerable to no one but themselves. He continues, the dominant elite justifies military intervention on the grounds that it is defending democracy from communism. He argues, actually, it is defending the capitalist world from social change, even if that change is peaceful, orderly, and democratic. And certainly after reading Grandin, you have to see that under no circumstances has the U.S. ever allowed any change in Latin America, even peaceful, not once. In his book, American Empire, scholar and Vietnam veteran and former West Point faculty member Andrew Bacevich critiques the myth that the U.S. involvement in Latin America and elsewhere has come through some unforeseen occurrence. Some nations achieve greatness, observed the historian Ernest May. The U.S. had greatness thrust upon it. They just threw it in our laps. Bacevich states that this view encapsulates the story of America's rise to power the way Americans themselves prefer to tell it. This is the myth of America, the city on the hill, the exception to great power aggression, a nation with noble designs that often blunders in its endless efforts to do good throughout the world. In this view of May and others, the view that all of us in this room have been raised on, the U.S., unlike other nations, achieved preeminence not by consciously seeking it, but simply as an unintended consequence of actions taken either in self-defense or on behalf of others. Okay? We're always being attacked, or we were just helping people everywhere. Bacevich writes that in practice, the myth of the reluctant superpower, I couldn't help myself, Americans asserting themselves only under duress and then always for the noblest of purposes, reigns today as the master narrative, explaining and justifying the nation's exercise of global power. Although he writes about the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I would suggest his critique of this myth holds for Grandin's thesis on U.S. wars in Central America during the Reagan era and other imperialist assaults throughout Latin America. And by the way, Bacevich is a fairly conservative guy. Fairly conservative guy. He has written for The Nation, but his two books on American militarism and American empire, excellent. Supposedly, we savage Central and South America for the best of intentions and to defend ourselves against tyranny, a thesis Grandin absolutely demolishes. The tragedy is that many U.S. citizens have bought the propaganda about noble intentions put forth by rulers in Washington and passed on uncritically by the mainstream media. Far too many citizens, even those critical of particular actions, such as in El Salvador in the 80s, are able to see the whole picture of imperialism to reject the entire basis of our policies in the Americas. Bacevich's point about the bipartisan nature of this myth and practice bears repeating. Both parties and virtually the entire foreign policy elite tacitly share a common vision and conform in practice to a strategic consensus of long standing. If we take Grandin and other critical scholars' work to heart, rejecting this consensus is a necessary condition to any hope of ending U.S. imperialism. Bacevich also discusses the scholarship of historian Charles Beard. author of An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States and Other Works, and draws some marvelous links between Beard's critique of U.S. imperial policies abroad and that of William Appleman Williams, whom we've read. He spends quite a bit of time discussing both of their works, and their works are amazingly similar on this issue we've been looking at. Beard's thesis was that foreign policy derived from domestic policy. Its primary purpose was to advance commercial interests. Once we understand the fundamental basis of U.S. imperialism as designed to support and defend class or commercial interests, it is quite easy, I would argue, to understand the radical critique of U.S. motives put forth by Grandin, Chomsky, Parenti, Arundhati Roy, William Bloom, etc. U.S. policy has nothing to do with democracy, freedom, and decency in our common sense understanding of these terms, but acts to defend capitalist interests that need the muscle of the U.S. military and government to back them up around the world. Beard's understanding of the U.S. empire is similar to Williams. American leaders chose intervention abroad in order to dodge politically difficult decisions at home. Decisions that might call into question the constitutional framework that guaranteed the privileges of the propertied classes. Basevich writes that Beard's own interpretation of American statecraft derived from his belief in two controlling maxims, that foreign and domestic policy were parts of the same thing. You want to understand what the U.S. does abroad, understand what the U.S. does at home first. And that nations are governed by their interests as their statesmen conceive these interests. In the case of the U.S., whose chief business, after all, was business, it still is, economic considerations ranked foremost among the factors determining how policymakers defined those interests. Following Williams' arguments, Beard asserts that industrialists, bankers, and farmers, and their advocates in Washington, had long since concluded that the domestic market alone would not satisfy their own, that is, class interests or the nation's requirements. If you remember, we discussed that quite a bit with Williams. We have too much surplus. They've got to dump it someplace. The dominant elite that controls U.S. domestic and imperial policy links its narrow class interests with the national security of the United States and covers it with talk of grander and nobler designs. All of this ideological spin is designed to get us to support the kinds of genocidal policies that Grandin describes in Empire's Workshop. Basevich tells us that viewed in this light, exporting economic surpluses, what Beard called the industrialist way of escape, constituted the overriding national interest. It was not simply a matter of making money, but of preserving long-standing arrangements for allocating power and privilege within American society, and that's the fundamental issue. In the pursuit to maintain these arrangements, the U.S. ruling class has attempted to crush any and all resistance throughout Latin America, with particularly horrendous, absolutely mind-numbing, violent results in Central America. No president or influential leader in U.S. history has ever mounted a principled challenge to this fundamental imperial policy. Let's take a break. So, we started a little late.
I was very interested to see, toward the end of Grandin's last chapter, a statement by Kirchner and Lula as to the ideals of the current social movements in Latin America, the desired goal being sought by these progressive countries. And it was to the effect of, well, we want capitalism, but under control. We want free trade. We want democracy. But we also want fairness and more equality and a greater distribution of wealth and so on. Now, that sounds pretty much like the old liberal goals of people like Roosevelt and the like. That sounds rather different from what you get from people like Chavez, who is allied with Castro, and he talks about a new socialism, socialism for the 21st century, and so on. So I wonder if there's a tension in the goals of some of the Latin American progressives. That isn't covered by Grandin. He just more or less accepts this statement of Lula and Kirchner.
In a brief time, I can't do justice to the talk that Tariq Ali gave at UCLA a number of months ago in his book, which is called Pirates of the Caribbean, in which he discusses these tensions and his ability to lay out an analysis. And I think he's absolutely the most incredible speaker I've ever heard. In the book, he's arguing about these different movements in Latin America, sort of the new socialism or the social democratic movements. And so you have Evo Morales and Chavez on the left. And he doesn't have too many nice things to say about Lula in Brazil. He believes, despite the rhetoric of Lula and the Workers' Party, that Brazil has made its peace with the U.S. and that kind of neoliberal regime. Brazil still has one of the greatest levels of inequality of any country in the world. Absolutely amazing, horrific violence, especially in the cities. It's been a couple of months since I read the book. His essential argument is that, and here you're talking about the largest country in Latin America, that it has been hurt by these policies, and it has not organized the base upon which he was elected, even though for certain segments of the population, things have improved. He doesn't prognosticate about exactly what may happen, but I think it's clear from his argument is that he prefers what's happening with Chavez and Morales in Brazil and the new president in Ecuador. That is, to what extent will the wealth, the resources of those countries be used to alleviate incredible suffering, as well as have some real sensitivity to the issues of global warming and the environment. One of the greatest parts of the rainforest in the world happens to be in southern Venezuela, near the Angel Falls. And in parts of Brazil, that rainforest has been cut down as they build more and more roads. So all of these environmental issues are also critical. It was also, just an aside, it was nice to read in Tariq Ali's book, a little plug, because he got the title of his book from reading a book of a very dear friend of mine, Marcus Rediker, who's a historian at the University of Pittsburgh, whose specialty is on pirates. And he's a very serious historian about the whole business of pirates in the 16th, 17th, 18th century.
Okay, I like the way that Grandin describes all these different groups, the Reagan people, Clinton people, and current Bush people, and some of them may be a little bit better than the others, but they all have different rhetoric and a different approach. And of course, the Bush new imperialism is the most aggressive and the worst probably, but I like the way he describes about the damage that they all do. And Jensen, that you're talking about, talks about this with Carter. He does say there at one point that we do sometimes have to work strategically, but that doesn't mean we should not criticize progressives, and I think that's a really good comment. A lot of people really don't get what neoliberal negative globalization is. Privatization, they stop the unions, they do all these things, and then the country ends up being in debt, and it's a whole pattern. It's slightly different maybe in different situations. And that's one thing that we need to bring out, I think, as leftists. How do we bring all of this out in a way that people can hear it and understand it? Carter, for example, he had people provoking the Russians before the whole thing in Afghanistan started. There's a lot of covert things that went on. You don't hear about this in the discussion.
Well, we know now from Ziggy Brzezinski's interview, Brzezinski was Carter's national security advisor, another hawk, that he advised Carter to begin using CIA involvement in Afghanistan 6 months before the Russians came in to Afghanistan. I think it was in July 79 and the Russians came in. And as you recall, Carter seemed to be absolutely shocked that the Russians were going to do this. He was certainly aware of this. And then, of course, we have the thing about not going to the Olympics. But there's so many ironies in this, because here's Brzezinski, again, a real hardliner, if you follow his career the last 25 years, just had a piece in Harper's in which he was testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying to the senators that our policy in Iraq is an absolute, total, catastrophic mess. And if you guys support going into Iran, it's going to even be more catastrophic. So when a guy whose Cold War credentials are, I mean, nobody can bait him and say, well, he's a liberal. Not a chance. And of course, Chalmers Johnson's analysis of blowback and all the money that went in to the Mujahideen and then the blowback in terms of what's been happening in the world, it shows you that you really can't predict what might occur. I mean, you can have some sense that, you know, you invade a country and there's going to be resistance, etc. But I never would have believed that, you know, I read these words in Harper's by Brzezinski. I mean, it's incredible. And, of course, you know, these guys move back and forth. And if a Democratic administration comes in, Brzezinski might end up being somebody's national security advisor.
Hi, I'm Jay Johnson from People's Republic of Santa Monica. Since this is being recorded, I think we should know who we are.
Right.
I take challenge with the author, with Grandin here. I'm really not so sure that he's got the full picture from history. I mean, he can recite what has happened here, all of which I would certainly agree. The question is, what is the extension of his argument? I think it was Jefferson who said, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. The price of empire is eternal vigilance. Roger Baldwin, who started the American Civil Liberties Union, we have to continually re-win our victories. It applies to ACLU, but it also applies to the Central Intelligence Agency and all of our efforts, in South America. Because the author spends time explaining in particular that all of the players of the Central America wars of the last 30 years, Otto Reich, Negroponte, Elliot Abrams, etc., all learned their craft, so to speak, in Central America. And then they have now applied it recently.
Yeah.
Well, they've applied it to a disaster. What lessons they've learned of manipulation of the press and how to undermine economies and terrorize a country and create civil wars, sure, they've been able to do it, but the result is a total disaster, a total failure. And while they've been doing it over in the Middle East, applying their great lessons, at the same time, their so-called successes in Latin and South America have completely reversed upon them with the new leaderships, which are nothing, well, at the very least, a reformist. And many are out and out absolutely revolutionary, the next step to it. So the author's point of how the U.S. has done these things, which is well and good, I'm not at all convinced that it's a success formula from their perspective, because current experience is it's the opposite.
Just a quick comment. One of the things that baffles me, I mean, you know, I read a lot, and like all of you here, and try to keep up on things, is, you know, when you're listening to people that, you know, let's say cut their teeth on these policies in Central America, which were horrific, and then take this expertise to Iraq, which by all counts, everyone, conservative, liberal, radical, whatever, it's a disaster. You know, whatever you may think about the underlying principles. And yet they never seem to suffer in that, you know, if you were to do this in a small business or in a school board in Santa Monica or whatever, you'd be gone. You'd lose your job. So even if you believe in the policy and you end up making these incredible mistakes, you would think that that would be it. You shake up the group, you fire some people. It hasn't happened. It's quite baffling to me. I just...
You know, in looking at Grandin, I drew some comparisons to Stephen Kinzer, who spoke in L.A., about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
There were a couple of points that he made. It was a terrific talk. It was just really graphic. One thing, he made a point which was, I thought, extremely interesting. He's talking about 14 American actions in the 20th century. He had some of 14 different ones. He says, in terms of the CIA covert actions, Guatemala, wherever, that in each of the four instances he identified, the CIA chief in that area opposed that action, felt it would be ineffective and opposed it, and it was carried out despite the objection, and the CIA chief was deposed, not by the outside, but by the inside. I thought that was remarkable. Seems very significant. I don't know what to make of it. At any rate, also Kinzer makes the point that from his analysis, every action that the United States took in Central America and elsewhere, whether it was direct military action or covert action, he felt the result was a failure, either in the sense of Bay of Pigs or a dictatorship that destroyed the population, whatever. So in this analysis, it's been a record of failure all the way through. And then I thought one additional point was in the CIA operations, where there were democratic, semi-democratic organizations and governments, because of the openness, the CIA was able to muster opposition to a legitimate government, because it is very easy to buy off people in poor countries, so that even a minimum amount of money can neutralize people who would have opposed these things, would support opposition, whatever. And he said that a result of that, and I thought this was very significant, is that when there are reformist governments with an impulse to go democratic, they're afraid to do that, because the U.S. government is able to take advantage of open situations and turn them around and destroy the government. So that the effect has been to stymie and arrest democratic development. And I think this one is worth contemplating.
For those of you not aware, the book by Stephen Kinzer is called Overthrow. And it certainly overlaps and raises many of the same things we've been discussing. And again, the irony, well, so here you have people within the Central Intelligence Agency whose object is to try as much as they can to really find out what's going on for the world and to support the U.S. state. And you have people who have some close-hand knowledge who then tell the government, this is not a good idea. They're supposed to be the experts. This is going to boomerang. We're going to have backlash. And political people overruling them. I mean, it's as if you have technically trained people, whatever you may think about the agency itself. I mean, I happen to think it's the leading terrorist organization on the planet. But there are people who have real knowledge in that organization, real skills, who study history and languages, and are trying to tell people above them that this is a wrong road we're taking. And often those experts closest to the ground are ignored. And then the other point, you're right, compared to the money that the U.S., that is us, the taxpayers, poured into Central America, in terms of what happened in Guatemala and Iran, it was chump change. I mean, a little bit of money, you're right, managed to pay off people, get people to be on strike, to not go to work. It's incredible. Yeah, I mean, Kermit Roosevelt wandering around Tehran in 1953, and they don't know if it's going to succeed, and he had a little money here, he had a little money there, and it worked.
Temporarily.
Yeah, temporarily. And that's why Jay's point's right. I mean, things change.
Temporarily, that is the major thing.
I want to venture into moral territory, and I want to go into the conclusion of Grandin, where he quotes Jean Kirkpatrick, where she says, "Thought set free from experience is unlimited by the constraints of experience or of probability. If history is not relevant, then the future is free from the past. Theories cut loose from experience are usually blindly optimistic. They begin not from how things are, but how they ought to be, and regularly underestimate the complexities and difficulties concerning how you get there from here." And then he takes that quote from Kirkpatrick and says how the policies that she and these various people who buy into, taking these various actions on maintaining that they see as being necessary, he says it perfectly here. Where is that? "America's imposition of free trade absolutism produces throughout the world perpetual instability, thus justifying the need for an imperial power to impose order." And his concluding paragraph, "Today's new imperial revolutionaries, however, continue to ignore perhaps the most obvious question raised by the United States imperial track record. If Washington was unable to bring prosperity, stability, and meaningful democracy to Latin America, a region that falls squarely within its own sphere of influence and whose population shares many of its values, then what are the chances that it will do so for the world?" And what I see is this interesting duality that first was really well articulated in William Appleman Williams about how not just American imperialism, but I think any empire that goes out and feels the confidence to subjugate other people and steals their resources has to go through a moral interpretation of that within themselves so that they can justify it to themselves and make it all rational. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who underwrote the efforts to go in and suck the Soviet Union into Afghanistan, how this was a really cool thing to do, and all these different ways in which we go and subvert these other populations to subvert their will temporarily so that economically we gain a temporary advantage. So here's Brzezinski on John Stewart saying how, you know, oh, this has been a terrible mess. Bush is doing a horrible thing in Iraq, and if we go into Iran, that'll be the end of America as a superpower. And this is the same guy who the neocons quoted, basically, in their playbook, who in the, was it the Grand Chessboard, whatever the name of his book was, it said that we need to control Central Asia. And in order to do that, we've got to topple Saddam, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. But the American public wouldn't be up for this absent some catalyzing event like, say, maybe a new Pearl Harbor or something like that.
Genesis, page 53, Project for a New American Century.
Project for a New American Century, page 53. Okay.
Wow.
So, rebuilding America's defenses. So here's the same guy, and here's the same blind spot. And all these people who talk about how your arguments about the Democrats, it's all very right on target, because we can't just talk about peace now. We have to talk about what now? We have to unplug the imperial paradigm, and that has to be what people understand is the project at hand and on the left.
The issues you raise, of course, we're going to come back to in June when we pull together Grandin, Parenti, and Williams, and to go back to those kinds of issues, because Brzezinski personifies a particular position. I mean, it could be Kissinger, it could be Brzezinski, or it's Dulles. So it's the position, and in terms of the moral, political, the moral issues that you raised, no resistance in Iraq, quick little smash victory with no resistance at all. Let's say if it's like Grenada, Panama, etc. No Brzezinski writing for Harper's. No Brzezinski going before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. No bleeding hearts about what's going on in Iraq. Everyone would have shut his or her mouth, almost everyone. You wouldn't have had a peep in the U.S. Senate and Congress for the most part, other than for people who were against these ideas of crushing other countries in principle, that it's not a good idea, even if it works. And, of course, they move back and forth. Whomever the Democratic president may be, Brzezinski may have a place. We know that one of the prime architects of U.S. globalization in Latin America, which has been shown on its own terms to be an absolute disaster in terms of development and GNP, etc., is Robert Rubin, who was Clinton's Secretary of Treasury, who is now Hillary Clinton's economic advisor. And he is going to push the same policies. And if he attempts to do this for any president, it's very clear now in terms of what's happening in Bolivia, in Argentina, even in Brazil, in Ecuador, and in Venezuela, that the Latin Americans are not, even in Nicaragua, okay, even in Panama, the Panamanians said to the U.S. that they're not going to sign this Central American treaty that they've been discussing. So the same policies, sometimes with the same people, are going to be foisted, in which on their own grounds have been shown to not work. As Grandin points out, with more state control and regulation, there were dramatically better rates of growth. I mean, let's leave aside all the ecological problems of that growth. But in terms of equality, standard of living, and growth, from 1945 through the early 70s, under something that we wouldn't call neoliberalism, but much more state-guided policies, things were getting better. So they've worsened under this policy that now people in Washington think they're going to try and foist it on Latin Americans. It's incredible. And it goes back to, you know, what Jay and Jack said. I mean, you've got these people who are now going to make decisions about things that clearly didn't work. And you know from your involvement in the government here locally that if somebody kept coming to your board or to the city council with these ideas that everybody knew was a disaster, that person would be run out of town. And yet, you can make him Secretary of Treasury. And it has a moral component because ultimately we are talking about the hopes and dreams of people to just have a minimal, decent life. I mean, so, yeah, social justice.
When you talk about disaster, you know, you don't have to hit everyone out of the park. You know, talking about lawyers and sharks and having to keep moving. And I think the United States imperial government, like a shark, they have to keep moving. They have to keep going. They're very intelligent sharks, but they're not necessarily thinking long term or thinking generations ahead. If they hit a ground ball and they've landed on first base, that's okay. And the one maybe unintended consequence of Iraq, there's not going to be a lot of blowback. The people are not united. The people are not one people. Latin America, I think the people have more in common with each other, have a common heart. You know, like whenever I feel down about, I think, like, where's the revolution going to come? I'm thinking of Latin Americans. That's where my hope lies, both in the United States and south of our border. But if we muck around in the Middle East and we don't do as great a job as we might have wanted to do, we're still moving. We're still, the war economy is still running, like you say. The United States isn't out of business. And maybe we sort of blundered upon something good. I mean, these people aren't going to unite and blow back against us necessarily, not in a country-by-country way. There's a lot of tribalism. There's a lot of infighting. So I don't necessarily think that what we see as a disaster, the right. ruling class does.
Right.
They may not, you know, it might not be a clean getaway, but they're getting something.
Now, that's a powerful way to put it. When we say, I mean, those of us in this room and many people we know and many people in the country, when we say it's a disaster or a tragedy, we mean in terms of the human cost, the human and ecological cost of what. Everybody's just raising hands here. For those who are in policy positions, their disaster is, right, it's not working, but they are going to be able to get away. There was a piece today in, I think it's ZNet or Counterpunch, by Patrick Coburn. I would suggest Patrick Coburn and Robert Fisk. I think they're the two best people in the world who have been reporting from Iraq. And Coburn's actually one of the few reporters in Iraq who actually leaves the safe zone in Baghdad. He's Alexander Coburn's brother, who writes for The Nation. And he said it's an absolute horrific catastrophe in terms of death and destruction and maybe 2 million refugees who've left the country. Very few, by the way, have been allowed to come to the United States. They're in Jordan, Syria, and elsewhere. So it's a human tragedy in the way you would think of a Greek tragedy. For people in power, again, to go back to especially what Jay was saying, people who made these decisions, Paul Wolfowitz has gone to the World Bank. Maybe he's following the trajectory of Robert McNamara, who made a wasteland of Vietnam and then went to the World Bank. So here's Wolfowitz now going to bring his expertise to the World Bank. They don't seem to suffer whatsoever. And, yeah, the U.S. could then move on. And so the disaster is hitting, you know, to use the baseball analogy, to hit for the cycle or get a home run, didn't happen because of the defense of the Iraqis. Otherwise, these guys would have been, you know, popping champagne, that stuff on the USS Lincoln when Bush landed. We would have seen that the way we saw with the parades in the spring of 1991 after the first Iraq war, just incredible and magnificent and so on. Those people have stopped that celebration, but the people who've done all that misery, not one is in jail, not one really, you know, they got rid of Rumsfeld, they had to get rid of somebody. So, you know, you hit the nail on the head.
It's true that they've hit a snag in the Middle East. They do have plans. You know, they have plans to control everything from space and keep globalization going in spite of our huge deficit and the fact that we just might have a huge economic depression in this country. And we have overproduction and wages for workers haven't gone up since the 70s. But they've got another year and a half to do something weird. I don't know if anybody heard the review on the radio this morning about Blackwater mercenaries. I mean, they can just operate and nobody can do anything. They're not under the military. They're not under civilian law. And they do whatever they want, pretty much.
Yeah.
So we're up against all kinds of real possible disasters, ecological and economic. And capitalism has to expand. This model doesn't care about the environment or working conditions or anything else. So how are we going to save the planet from ecological and economic devastation? Because there's only so much time to stop global warming, and nothing short of a worldwide revolution, I don't think, would save the planet right now. I mean, I don't know. Even Negroponte resigned his position, saying there was too much graft going on over there, so maybe there's hope.
Well, of course, I should remind you that Negroponte has now become Deputy Secretary of State and will actually be in charge of what's going to go on for Latin America, by the way. And we know his role in helping to run the death squads out of Honduras during the Contra War. So I don't think it's an accident that he's going to be back in the Americas.
Jay made a comment about Latin America as turning left as sort of a failure of the U.S. policy. But I would say that if Chavez didn't have oil, and if it wasn't for him, I'm not sure anybody would really speak up. I would say that he could sort of fund some of these left-wing governments. Another thing, what happens when you have a dominant country like the U.S. is that other countries will unite against them. It's a much bigger deal to try to fight off a whole group of countries. And that happened with Germany. It happens with a lot of countries. Kinzer was kind of interesting because someone made a very interesting comment. So many people look negatively on the CIA. But someone asked the question that, what if the CIA was able to overthrow Hitler, you know, while he was weak or before he came to full power? Now, there would be a good example of, possibly a good example of a CIA action that might produce good
results.
Someone
asked that question when Kinzer
was...
Yeah. It's an interesting question, but given what we know about the connection of the U.S. government with corporations and U.S. corporations in Germany... with the work of Edwin Black and his book on IBM, etc., that the odds would be that there would be no chance of the CIA overthrowing Hitler, maybe overthrowing a certain leader, but certainly not overthrowing fascism, because those interests were quite akin to U.S. interests until the Japanese attacked the United States on December 7th. And as you recall, Germany declared war on the U.S., The U.S. essentially never raised a finger while hundreds of thousands of Jews were being taken to camps in Eastern Europe and in Germany. So it's a powerful agency, but it's an agency that always has... There have been some rogue people in the CIA. There's no doubt about that. And if you want to get an interesting cinematic version of police activities, though, with the FBI, I would recommend the movie The Breach to you. But the notion is, yes, there have been people within the CIA and the FBI who have been rogue elements. Some have sold secrets to the Soviets, the Russians, etc. But the CIA, when you study the history of the Central Intelligence Agency, has essentially been the arm of U.S. policy and the arm of corporate Wall Street State Department policy. They, not on their own, just run around, decide, for example, to get involved in Project Phoenix in Vietnam and kill thousands of Vietnamese. Not on their own did they decide, well, we should go in and overthrow Castro. They take orders. Same way with the Pentagon. The Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency are very powerful, but they are not the central levers of power in this society. They act on behalf of even more powerful elements as well. And as pointed out, they have made mistakes in terms of what they thought might unfold. I mean, they said, well, the Cubans are all going to fold and there's going to be no problem. Well, they evidently blew that. But
I want to make some comments on Grandin's book and get your observations on it. I was surprised how up-to-date it was, how current. You know, it talks about Iraq, Abu Ghraib prison, Hugo Chavez. It even has the comment of Pat Robertson wanting to assassinate Hugo Chavez.
Yeah.
What I saw in the whole book, from one end to the other, was he mostly addresses American plutocrats dealing with South American plutocrats. Kind of cursory observation about the power of the people. My opinion is that eventually the population itself does rise up and they have a tremendous voice in overthrowing these policies. Just like the people of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries, they rose up and overthrew their systems. Also, he has very little mention of Fidel Castro. I think Fidel Castro has had tremendous influence on the people of South America. From what I see in Fidel Castro, no one wants to adopt his system of government in South America. But what they love about him is that he has been able to survive for 50 years against the United States. And they love the fact that this David has been able to stand up to this Goliath, and it's the underdog mentality. And they love that he was able to stand up and take care of the United States. And that's, when it comes to the future of South America, I feel like our time is up there. We are bogged down in Iraq. We're going to stay in Iraq. We're not going to stay there for freedom and democracy. We're going to stay there because of the oil. We're stretching our power all over the world. I don't think we'll regain our hegemony that once had in South America. And these neocons, the right-wingers who he talks about in the book, their time is going to be up in 2 years. Do you think we're going to go back into South America and regain the hegemony we once had, or is our time up?
Well, making predictions very difficult. Tariq Ali discussed this. The particular historical circumstance now appears to indicate that the almost unlimited power of the U.S. in past decades in South and Central America, that the U.S. does not have the power that it did, just simply to go in, and it's attempted, as we saw with Venezuela. But as it, the way it essentially was able to do what it did in Chile in 73, in Guatemala in 54, they go into Panama, Grenada, etc., etc. The relative power of countries in Latin America has shifted. And I would agree with Laura that, in fact, and I think Tariq Ali argues this too in his book, that he feels it's the one place on the planet that a real challenge is going to be made to, you know, this neoliberal U.S. power. At the same time, and to connect this to what Ken said, it's not necessarily the connection of the U.S. as a nation with nations in South America. As Andre Gunder Frank's work indicates a bit and others, it's the connection of those who rule here who connect with those who rule in South America and in the Middle East, etc. They have more in common with each other than any of them have with us. So this is Andre Gunder Frank's analysis. The center of the center, so the center of the U.S., the rulers here, are allied with the center of other countries. The U.S. simply is overstretched in terms of what it can do militarily. But while it's a lot more expensive now to get people to do things, I mean, it costs a lot more money to overthrow governments than it did 50 years ago. Well, there's still a lot of people you can buy out. Okay, we got, you know, how many of those princes are in the Saudi Arabian desert? Okay. Those guys have been doing our bidding since they sat with Roosevelt on that ship in 1944 or whatever. So those connections continue. So the battle is between progressive forces here and our center and progressive forces in those countries against their rulers. And then the hope, of course, is that people begin to see that the interest of Venezuelans for a decent society and for a decent environment and to be able to raise their kids is essentially closer to what we think than it is for each of us in terms of ruling powers. And I don't know whether that's going to change. I mean, we have had, you know, people talk about this is the oldest democracy on the face of the earth, okay? We've had different administrations, but this is the longest lasting single regime. We have had one regime. There's been no fundamental change since 1789. It's still a regime built on private property, class power, mainly white men holding power who are wealthy. That has not changed. And they're not going to stop. They can't. I mean, that's the shark thing. They just can't help themselves. They have to do this. So we got to be careful about prediction. And if the U.S. bombs Iran, I would say all bets are off in terms of the Middle East and lots of places in the world, because then, you know, the potential is you could have World War III. So Iran, you know. On that pleasant note, adjourn to Izzy's and continue this discussion.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.
See you at Izzy's. Yeah. Let's go to Izzy's.